Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free and available when you're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it and put it on an iPod, iPad, your computer, and then hit play. Today we have a real interesting show, which was put together initially based on observations at the Carmel Valley eDiscovery Conference that, you know, wow, each of these speakers all have perfect radio voices, and they're each involved in eDiscovery. And given the format of a podcast, why not have some fun highlighting vocal skills in a single show? What makes things even more interesting is all three are highly respected in the field and come at eDiscovery from different angles, as we have a respected judge, an in-house eDiscovery expert, and an outside lawyer. So from these different perspectives, we're going to talk about challenges to the meet and confer process, taking into account we all have different perspectives. The question is how to make meet and confers more useful, and we'll delve into some of the challenges which occur in a meet and confer process. This topic sort of came to me recently. I was reading an LTN article entitled, "Are Meet and Confer Efforts Doing More Harm Than Good?" And I know both of the authors, Chris Boning and Dan Toll, and I thought this question was a good one for this panel. So we're going to explore some of these challenges and potential solutions to how Rule 26F works in practice between parties with differing amounts of data and differing amounts of knowledge about what the data likely contains. So first, let's introduce the panel. Judge David Waxey is a United States Magistrate Judge for the United States District Court in Kansas City, Kansas. He's been a past guest on ESI Bytes, including one of our judicial panelists at the live podcast we did at Carmel, where we talked through predictive coding issues. He's authored several pioneering decisions in electronic discovery disputes, including Williams v. Sprint United Management Company, interpreting the scope of electronic discovery to include metadata, and Williams v. Sprint United Management Company later in the, a few years later, using the procedure created by the new Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to resolve issues of inadvertently produced electronically stored information. Alex Ponce de Leon is a discovery counsel for Intel Corporation. His practice focuses on intellectual property, complex commercial litigation, and government investigations. Prior to joining Intel, Alex was a litigator at an AmLaw 50 law firm, where he managed e-discovery issues for numerous large and complex litigation matters. Before practicing law, Alex was a policy advisor for the California State Legislature and a management consultant for Accenture, where he worked advising the city of Boston. Alex received his BA from Brown University, his MSc from the London School of Economics, and JD from Northwestern University School of Law. Final guest, Martin Tully, is a trial litigator and national head of Chicago-based Cat & Mutin's electronic discovery and evidence practice. 2001, Martin was featured in the National Law Journal's Defense Verdicts of the Year, Part 2, for his role in Research Systems Corp v. IPSOS SA, in which a French multinational market research firm had been sued in the plaintiff's hometown of Evansville, Indiana. He's co-chair of the ABA's Trial Practice Courtroom Technology Subcommittee and serves as web editor for the ABA section of litigation newsletter Technology for the Litigator. He's also a member of the Sedona Conference Working Group on Electronic Document Retention and Production, Working Group 1, and the Seventh Circuit eDiscovery Pilot Program. Before we ask the first question, I also want to add and make it clear that the answers for each participant here and also on past podcasts are personal views, and I don't want to infer that they represent the views of the organization which they work with. So now let's get started here. Hopefully everyone's done their prep vocal exercises, and why don't we start around the group, starting with Judge Waxey, Alex, and then Martin, on how did you each get started in electronic discovery?
Well, mine was pretty simple because I was randomly assigned a case that had an e-discovery issue, so I had to learn it and write on it, and when you write the first time on a subject, suddenly they think you're an expert, and that's where I got.
Okay, Alex?
Well, for me, it was a matter of being at the right place at the right time, depending on whether you like e-discovery or not. When I started my legal practice for a law firm, when I walked through the door, there was a very large case with very substantial e-discovery component. And of course, since the manager in charge was not that interested in e-discovery, and I had a little bit of management consulting experience, they tapped me to lead the way, and the ball just got rolling, and people looked to me time and time again, and things kind of evolved from there. But yeah, e-discovery is different from our regular discovery, and in many ways. And I think a lot of times, way back when, people were intimidated by it, so a lot of times they deferred to others, and I was the other,
the fall guy.
Yeah.
Martin, how about yourself?
Well, thanks for having me, Carl. I appreciate it, and great to be working with you, Judge and Alex. I would have to say that I've always had somewhat of an interest in technology and been somewhat of a procedure geek, so there's no better place where those two things intersect in sometimes an explosive manner than an e-discovery. But what really got me into it was about 7 years ago when I saw that the amendments to the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure were going to be forthcoming. I presented to my partners that, boy, you know, we really ought to have a practice group on this because I think it's going to be essential going forward. And my reward for having made that suggestion was, congratulations, you get to lead the practice group, but don't let that interfere with anything else that you're doing. But probably the biggest thing that got me into it, both feet first, was a case that I was working on in a large antitrust class action matter where the federal judge, knowing also that the changes in the rules were about 9 months down the road, said, look, they're going to go into place, so we're going to start conducting this case as if they were already here. So we got to learn some of the nuances pretty quickly, even before the rules were officially adopted.
Okay, well, let's dive into the topic. And Judge Waxy, I know you've got a lot of very vocal and strong views on the meet and confer process. And why do you believe the meet and confer and cooperation is so important in the e-discovery process?
Well, I think the simple answer is because right now e-discovery costs way too much, takes way too long. And the question is, what do we do about it? We're not going to be able to do away with e-discovery, so we've got to improve our process of handling it. And the more I've looked at it from a practical point of view, I think one of the biggest reasons it costs so much and takes so long is people approach it from an adversarial position, almost in some cases as if it's some kind of athletic game you're playing to see who can win on each level of the battle. And if you go back to Rule 1 of the Federal Rules, the goal of the Federal Rules is to find a way of achieving the just, speedy, and inexpensive. It doesn't say a thing about keeping track of who wins, and yet there are too many counsel that I think get off on the wrong track there. So what do? We have to have cooperation, and the starting point with the cooperation is set out in the rules. And if you follow the rules correctly and the cases that interpret the rules, it's just clear the best way to proceed is to start with a cooperative attitude. And, you know, sometimes when I do this little speech to lawyers, the response I get is, but Judge, you're forgetting I have a duty of zealous advocacy and I can't cooperate with the other side. And I've done enough research in this area that I can easily point out to lawyers that make that statement, that duty of zealous advocacy started out in the ABA Model Code and was there until 1983. And it was taken out in 1983 for this very reason, that it costs too much to have zealous advocacy in discovery. So there's really no need for that thought to be interfering with counsel's ability to cooperate with the other side. And, you know, one of the things that's happened in the past few years on this whole problem is the federal court set up a conference at Duke Law School a couple years ago to look at this question of cost and delay. And it was just clear for all the participants there that one of the key solutions to cost and delay is cooperation. And the key, I think, is clients have to recognize this and then tell their attorneys that's the kind of behavior they want. So that's why I think the whole meet and confer and cooperation is so important. It's the only real solution to cost and delay.
So, Alex, hypothetically, you know, if you go into the meet and confer, a lot of it is you know, knowing the cards you're holding and knowing the data you have. And corporations, of course, have a better handle on their data than their outside law firms. Do you believe corporations can face challenges preparing their counsel for meet and confer process?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's an excellent segue. And I think, just like Judge Waxy mentioned, the cooperation up front is critical. But if your outside counsel doesn't have the sort of knowledge of the data landscape, then it's going to be very difficult for them to be cooperative, and it's going to be very difficult for them to know where to draw the line. And I think I think that's where people fall back into being adversarial and being protectionist in a sense, because maybe they haven't done their homework and they don't know where to draw the line. I think corporations in general, it's somewhat of a double-edged sword. On one hand, we've got a very complex data landscape, and knowing which parts of the enterprise are going to be relevant is going to be immensely helpful for that meet and confer, for having a good productive meet and confer where we're being collaborative rather than combative, and that's a difficult balance to find. Oftentimes, I hear about overzealous outside counsel who want to go in and do a prolonged data mapping exercise. So that's the sort of other extreme. So on one hand, we could have outside counsel that are not appropriately engaged and may go into the meet and confer without the knowledge necessary. And then on the other side of the spectrum, we can have overzealous outside counsel who want to map the entire universe, when at the end of the day, the case is going to implicate a much narrower part of the data landscape. I'm personally not a huge fan of data mapping. I know it was the buzzword a few years ago. I think a more targeted approach will create much better results than have outside counsel know a lot more important information when they go into the meet and confer. I think it's a matter of having them knowing. Having outside counsel know their case early, having them know the players, the human beings, having them getting to know the products if it's a patent case, getting them to the forefront and having them meet these people, talk about data, talk about where the data resides, map the small compartments that you need to map, work your way outward from those individuals, from those key custodians, and then take that knowledge into the meet and confer. On one hand, you've got a very complex organization, like you mentioned, the corporation. But on the other, that complexity has underneath it some decent bureaucracy as to where data is kept. It's difficult, but I think oftentimes outside counsel gets overwhelmed and they try to bite off more than they even need to chew.
You know, I think Alex is exactly right about what needs to be the starting point, but there's another little piece that I see too often ignored, and that is lawyers on both sides of the case look at what kind of case is it and plan their e-discovery, both preservation and discovery process, without focusing on what issues are actually in dispute. I'll get counsel that'll say, well, this is an employment case. I've got to see all the personnel files and all the HR rules and regs. And when I focus them down on, well, tell me what issue in this case, what factual issue is actually in dispute. And too often, lawyers have never focused on that. They just start out with the case and don't get narrowed down to what's really in dispute, because the discovery is about claims and defenses, and it's only needed if the claims and defenses are in dispute. If you've got an agreement, the first step you ought to do in handling the case is get pinned down that agreement with the other side, which would then narrow the scope of discovery and preservation.
So Martin, you know, a lot's coming in your direction here, so what variables make the meet and confer process challenging for outside counsel to obtain proportionate outcomes, and and not result in additional delay and additional work and then disputes between the parties. I mean, I would think on the one hand, you've got the internal battles of getting your firm educated, or not your firm, but lawyers in general, on how to attack data intelligently. And then you've got the adversary, who may not have any data or very little, and trying to get them to agree to, say, not preserve files that probably have very little impact in the case. You know, what are your thoughts there?
Well, as both Judge Waxy's comments and Alex's comments make very clear, the single greatest enemy to e-discovery, reasonableness, and proportionality these days is probably asymmetry. And it's asymmetry in a number of different forms. As Alex mentioned, one is the knowledge base. What does the producing party understand about their sources of electronically stored information that may be in play? And that goes to the judge's comment of what issues are in play, because you have to start there. But then once you've nailed down what the issues are, what are the potentially responsive sources of ESI, and understanding what they mean and what's involved in potentially reviewing them and producing them. Because if you don't understand it, then you're going to have a hard time either making representation to the other side or to the court. The other area of asymmetry is in terms of knowledge of best practices. There are obviously a lot of tools that are out there these days and approaches that can be utilized by parties on both the requesting side and the producing side to keep costs down and achieve reasonableness and proportionality. And if you're not even familiar with those things, then they're probably not going to come to the forefront. And related to that, of course, is technology. And I know, Carl, that you can't stand technology, so I won't try to talk about it too much. But once again, there are different tools that are both here and have been around for a while and will come in the future that I think the ABA rules of ethics are starting to indicate that lawyers have a duty of competency, and that's also a duty of making sure that you're keeping up with what are the best tools available to try to keep these costs down and do things in a reasonable basis. The other element of asymmetry, I think Judge Waxy mentioned earlier, and that is an asymmetry between the interests of the requesting and the producing party. If the interest is not to achieve proportionality and reasonableness, but to achieve some sort of a advantage that may have little to do with the merits of the case, but more about extracting some kind of a punishment or making life intolerable because of either a misguided notion of zealous advocacy or just a good old-fashioned, we're going to achieve more through discovery in this case than we could in the merits, then you're going to have some difficulty in a meet and confer because the party's interests are not aligned. The key is, of course, really trying to achieve balance, and balance sounds like proportionality, and it should be. And where you have the most successful meet and confers is when you have parties that have a roughly equal amount of issues with respect to their ESI and roughly a similar amount of knowledge with respect to both best practices and technology, and then you see the process work out very well. It's where you have asymmetry and a number of these different levels that I think the real problems start to escalate.
So, Judge Waxy, I'm going to throw a couple statistics that came out in the article I referenced, our meet and confer efforts doing more harm than good. And these were real eye-openers to me. They cited the Federal Judicial Center survey for March 12, 2012. They surveyed 10,000 attorneys and was answered by 36% of the recipients, which is a pretty good response rate. In it, the lawyers surveyed found that 72% of the lawyers met with opposing counsel to plan discovery, yet only 40% of them discussed ESI, and only 60% discussed preservation obligations. The overwhelming number of meet and confers occurred by telephone or video conference, that was 86%, and only 9% occurred in person. 25% occurred by email exchanges. 73% of the respondents indicated they believe that they could meet the requirements of the meet and confer in a single 30-minute or less conversation. And 19% of that number had meet and confers which lasted less than 10 minutes. Yeah, it would appear that we're not accomplishing much in the way of detailed discussions to intelligently plan for discovery of ESI, as was hoped by the meet and confer section. I want to add anecdotally, I do these local networking groups, and I recently helped set one up in another city outside of Pittsburgh in the Midwest, and we were talking about this exact issue at our meeting, and the vast majority of participants agreed the meet and confer process is usually a train wreck. So what's your reaction to this?
Well, I'm afraid it's probably true, but I think there are several levels of solution here. One of the first is we've got to do a much better job educating counsel on technology and e-discovery issues. And I hate to say it, but we also have a lot of judges still need more education on the same issues. So that's the starting point, is some of these don't work because the lawyers don't understand what's really at issue in the discovery side of the case. The next thing that happens, it ties into what I said earlier, lawyers go into these meet and confers a lot of times without really studying their own case. They don't know what issues are really in dispute, and therefore they take this broad approach to what ought to be done in the meet and confer and then just touch the surface of it instead of really getting into what should have been done. One thing that I think is changing is we're in the process of revising our what we call e-discovery guidelines to try and give more specificity to what lawyers should be doing in the meet and confer process. And I think lawyers that really understand e-discovery and have focused on the issues in their case, they can really accomplish something in a meet and confer. And I think one of the things that is so clear to me in the bigger cases is it's not a meet and confer meeting, it's a meet and confer process. This is not something that's going to take place in one 10-minute phone call if you're going to do it right. And I think this ties back into one of the other conclusions out of the Duke conference, is that we really need more judicial management than we're getting now, and that requires that judges, when they get the Rule 26 report, really sit down or at least talk to the attorneys on phone about what is going on in this case. Too often, busy judges and busy lawyers just deal with the surface on these things. They get a scheduling order in place. You know, and there are some cases where there's no meet and confer, there's no scheduling conference, it's just a paper sent in and the judge signs it. That is not going to help get the cost and delay reduced. So I think the problem's out there. We just got to keep working on what are the solutions to that problem.
So, Martin, one of the great places to look for data is the work that you and some of your colleagues are doing in the Seventh Circuit e-discovery pilot program. And its second survey was cited in that LTN article I mentioned earlier, the Seventh Circuit e-discovery pilot program phase two survey. And as part of the Seventh Circuit e-discovery pilot program, participants respond to surveys at the end of each phase of the program. According to the phase two final report, the results of the survey after phase two indicate that, quote, in those cases in which the principles did have a perceived effect, those efforts were overwhelmingly positive with respect to cooperation and ability to resolve disputes amicably, ability to obtain relevant documents, and zealously represent clients in fairness. However, going further, according to the report, in these cases, quote, the consensus view among attorneys appears to be that the principles resulted in more discovery disputes, more discovery and discovery, longer discovery periods, and greater expense for discovery and litigation in general, end quote. So the survey results appear to compel the conclusion that early detailed discussion of e-discovery issues may be leading to more disputes about discovery and greater expense and delay. In short, that's exactly the opposite of what e-discoveries have been preaching. So what do you think about these results and any explanations?
Well, Carl, and that was an interesting outcome of that survey, and it's part of the reason why the Seventh Circuit e-discovery pilot program continues to do surveys to see what the impact of both the principles on e-discovery and the model order that has been adopted by a number of the judges in the Northern District of Illinois, and what kind of impact it's been having on cases. And a few observations that I think might lead to some of those survey results. Number one, and I hate to say it, but it's consistent with Judge Waxie's comments earlier. I think a lot of it stems from blissful ignorance. I think you had a lot of parties that were just simply not doing a number of the best practices that we ordinarily think about are the types of things that should be done in any case involving any kind of significant amount of electronic discovery. And this was forcing them to actually, perhaps for the first time, actually think about it and go through it. And if you imagine the world of broadcast television many years ago, when you had three channels basically to choose from, you know, the decision of what to watch wasn't that complicated. There were three channels, you picked one and off you went, or you didn't watch at all. Take it into the modern era where you have thousands of channels on cable TV and satellite, and now you have people that are actually trying to dive in and figure out what's going on and what do I do, and I have to go through this checklist of model approaches and best practices, and perhaps these are things they've never done before. So it may actually be generating some more work, which then leads to a question that has been raised both here and in other jurisdictions, and that is there truly a set of principles and a model order for how to conduct e-discovery that is universally applicable? Should all cases go through this list of this checklist or this list of meet and confer targets that one should go through in terms of what we think about as best practices? I know that in the Southern District of New York, it's been suggested that the principles or protocols should only apply to certain cases, which are of a size and complexity, that principles and protocols like this would be particularly useful where you have to go through these things or it's going to be a train wreck. But the question has been raised, if you're dealing with the small case, small data, or small stakes, do these same sorts of principles that apply to the terabyte upon terabyte type of case, should they equally apply to those cases? Are they generating more effort? And was there some benefit to blissful ignorance? Now, those are the topics that I think we can all continue to debate, and that's why we're having this particular podcast, is because these are all good questions. But I think some of it is driven by blissful ignorance, and people are for the first time delving into things they didn't do before. And I'll just add, another part of that is probably what I mentioned earlier, is this asymmetry with respect to knowledge on behalf of both the producing and the responding party, as well as what are the real interests of the parties. Are they really interested in achieving proportionality and reasonableness and reducing costs, or are they using the tools and protocols and standing orders as a weapon? And I hate to sound cynical, but that's been known to happen from time to time in the history of law, is folks will use things to their advantage. And so the answer isn't clear because the survey doesn't get down to that level of detail, but those are some observations that just in my practice in the Northern District of Illinois would suggest might be some of what's driving this.
Carl, I agree with what Martin said, but I want to add two little pieces. One, I think you've got to remember that the Rule 1 mantra has just, speedy, and inexpensive. And sometimes what's going on in cases is they really aren't trying to get to a just result. So that's where courts have got to use judicial management to make sure that we're not just focused on speed and expense. There's got to be a just outcome. The second piece that I want to mention is that clearly asymmetrical litigation is problematic. But I think what's interesting to me is in the past few years, cases that were in the past clearly asymmetrical are changing in that social media is having a huge impact on lots of individual parties and litigation. Some people end up creating as much data on their Facebook and Twitter and all these other accounts as the small business may have in their corporate accounts. And when you start really enforcing the e-discovery preservation obligations and search obligations on the individual's data that they haven't even thought about that's out there in a cloud someplace, it's a different view of symmetry.
Alex, before I ask the general question I had, something struck me from something the judge said earlier in the program about companies sort of taking the bull by the horns and trying to help educate their outside counsel. Is that something that companies are in a good position to do, or does that sound easier than it is in practice from your conversations with other in-house people?
Sure. I think that's a fantastic framework, and actually that is primarily, that is one of the primary things I do day to day. So it's fantastic to hear others motivating my colleagues on the corporate side to do so. I don't think it is too much to do. I don't think it is onerous for in-house counsel to take that role. And that's primarily one of the things I do is trying to help outside counsel understand where to draw the line, where to find the right level of risk, because outside counsel are inherently risk adverse, and it's up to outside counsel to kind of find the right risk level that's appropriate for that case. And knowing the case, knowing the custodians, like Judge Waxy mentioned, knowing the issues that are really at stake, it's important to do that. It's up to outside, to in-house counsel to help motivate outside counsel to find that right level.
So let's go into sort of one of the general mantras, which I think our general mantras oftentimes get us in the most trouble. And one of the standard pieces of advice I hear many e-discovery practitioners say is preserve broadly, yet produce narrowly. And it seems like this might be the default approach, which might be causing some of the over-preservation messes that we saw, for example, in the Microsoft letter presented in Dallas in 2011 and in front of a blue ribbon meeting of the rules subcommittee, which I might add came out of that Duke conference, is one of the byproducts that Duke conference that Judge Waxy has mentioned. And in that meeting, they were discussing over-preservation and possibly, you know, some of the solutions on sanctions with an eye to amending the rules. And Microsoft pointed out that for every document they produced in trial, they went through a list of what was collected, reviewed, and et cetera, they got to a staggering number of 340,000 pages of documents under preservation. So can this over-preservation situation identified by the Microsoft letter create challenges in getting agreement with your own lawyers on what should be preserved? I mean, this seems to be a tension that impacts the meet and confer process.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I think it circles back to your other question about the role of outside counsel and in-house counsel and working together to find the right level of preservation, of production, and so forth. And I think this is a perfect example of that. The team and the entire team, in-house and outside, really needs to invest more time when it comes to preservation as well, knowing the case, knowing the claims, knowing your witnesses. The problem that I see all too often is that outside counsel will put someone on hold very, very quickly. It just takes a few seconds for outside counsel to send an email and say, the following 180 people need to be placed on hold because these 180 people at one point received one email on a particular issue in the case. It takes a little bit more time and energy to kind of think through that list and come up with something that really goes to the heart of the case, that really goes to the issues and the claims and the key custodians. I think all too often, and the fault here lies on both in-house and outside counsel, in that all too often outside counsel don't understand the time and energy and resources that goes into preservation. So even today, even with the numbers that we're seeing from our friends at Microsoft, 340,000 pages of documents are preserved. I think many practitioners don't understand how expensive it is to preserve 340,000 pages. They think hard drives are cheap. They think data, they think memory is cheap, and they don't understand that to preserve those 340,000 pages, it's going to be very, very expensive. And we've also heard some really great statistics. I actually saw that Microsoft updated their study and now have new numbers for 2012, which they are working to publish through the Lawyers for Civil Justice. And the Lawyers for Civil Justice are working on a proposal to the Rules Subcommittee. And it's actually gotten worse, exponentially worse. So even the 2012 numbers from Microsoft seem to be indicating that the trend towards overpreservation is getting worse and worse. And I think that's probably caused by cheaper storage and just the sort of data explosion that we see at companies, whether you're a big company like Microsoft and Intel and so forth, or even a small enterprise. If you're a small business, the amount of data that you're dealing with is probably at least 100 times greater than it was just 10 years ago. And it also resonated with me because if we look at Judge Rader and the model order, another quantitative bite there is the fact that only 0.0074% of documents that get produced end up getting used at trial. And that to me is just absolutely remarkable. I think every step of the EDRM model needs to really be critically analyzed by in-house and outside counsel. We need to try to tighten down preservation, but I think there's even production. The mantra we started out with was preserve broadly and produce narrowly. I think we could even be producing even more narrowly because at every every stage of the process, there's work that needs to be done. And I think Martin made an excellent point, which is there's a lot of knowledge out there where our colleagues, where attorneys and judges alike can be educated and can learn more about this. But I think sometimes it seems like people don't want to educate themselves and don't necessarily want to work these numbers downward. And I think that's where good in-house counsel comes into play. To put a price tag on this, preserving 340,000 documents is immensely expensive. And if it doesn't go to the core issues of the case, if it doesn't go to the crux of the items that are at issue, then we need to think twice about preserving that much.
You know, Alex, when you mentioned the EDRM model, it's funny. Back in 2006, 2007, I built a board game modeling e-discovery called Discovery Land, and we used big dollar bills from $1 million to $500,000. I think the smallest denomination was $50,000. And when we worked through the steps of how to actually do a project, the first step in our board game that me and a graphic artist from a charter high school came up with was the planning stage. And we actually came up with the EDRM model before the EDRM model came out. But that planning stage basically replicated the whole rest of the EDRM model. And I always thought it was the most important step. And it was interesting, but it's not in there. I suppose it's embedded in each step that you plan, but really that first step of planning is just really critical, or you can really run a train wreck.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a good attorney knows his or her deadlines, but I think all too often good attorneys don't really think about the e-discovery aspects as essentially a very big data engagement and don't think about the 100 other deadlines that are baked into that process and those 100 deadlines that are baked into what you would describe as the planning stage. I think all too often people are driven by the sort of judicial deadlines, which are, of course, the most important thing, but they look at discovery as one deadline and one discovery cutoff and maybe a few production deadlines, and they don't think about the dozens of other deadlines that need to be engineered backwards from that point. It's probably the most complex aspect of the case from a sort of workflow aspect. So it takes a lot of planning.
So let me add a couple things to the problem you raised. I think one, looking at it from the really big picture, we hear these references to hundreds of thousands of documents preserved, one or two used. What we forget is most cases never use any documents. The problem that we don't deal with is the fact that cases primarily get resolved by settlement. The last federal numbers I saw, it's like less than 1% of the civil cases go to trial. And I get responses, well, but we know that dispositive motion is the most key process in the case. But if you look at that, it's about a third on average of cases that go away on dispositive motion. So focusing on trial is not the way to get to just speedy and expensive. You got to be realistic and realize the odds are this case is going to settle. How do we come up with a settlement process? Now, the other thing, from the big picture point of view, you know, when I first started doing this stuff 10 years ago, the huge problem was the cost of storage in addition to the cost of search, and that's why preservation was such a big problem. Now, we obviously have more data. We have so much cheaper storage that that's not a disincentive to saving it. And what I hope is that technology finally gets to the point where the cost of search and review gets down so low that we don't have to worry so much about what we preserved, because the only reason preservation is a problem is store it and search it. If those two costs can be substantially reduced, this doesn't remain as one of the huge problems it now is.
So, Martin, one of the points that Judge Waxley made earlier is about Rule 1, inexpensive or just speeding inexpensive resolution. And, you know, as I try to weave technology in this a little bit more, no surprise there. One of the chips I would think defendants have if they want a meaningful meet and confer is if they come up with a negotiated, agreeable, and targeted collection, that maybe they can provide data quicker to the adversary. So isn't speed the best chip the defense has to being more open?
Well, it's one of the chips that a producing party can utilize. And I would say producing party as opposed to defendant, because as Judge Waxley points out, symmetry is not necessarily on one side of the V or the other. It really depends on the situation of the parties involved. So I like to think in terms of producing party and requesting party, because they're not necessarily synonymous with plaintiff and defendant anymore. Speed is important, but quality and cost are equally important. And some of the problems or challenges that you face is that, sure, if you're dealing with a situation in the paper world, for example, where one side is in possession of something that resembles the last scene of the Raiders of the Lost Ark, and the other side is asking for where in this vast warehouse would I find the documents that would be relevant to my matter, certainly the requesting party would like to be pointed out to the exact boxes that would be most relevant. Certainly the requesting party would like or to be given a map by which that party could find the most relevant documents. But again, you, number one, have to have a situation where the producing party is motivated to do that, and hopefully it's because of speed and cost and quality in advancing the ultimate resolution of the case in a just manner. But there's also a couple of very important components there. One is trust, and the other is understanding. And the trust component brings into this whole concept, once again, of the adversarial or non-adversarial nature of discovery. If it's adversarial, it's going to be very difficult to get to that level of trust. Likewise, understanding is important. If you have one party, whether it's the requesting party or the producing party, is just not very well versed in how things are done, what makes a search tool effective, why certain types of ESI would not be particularly useful in the case. Absent that understanding, you're going to have a hard time getting to that point, and you're going to have a requesting party that wants to see the entire warehouse at the end of the Raiders of the Lost Ark movie. So I think that, yes, the answer is you can, if you could, as a producing party, sit down with the other side and say, here's what I want to do. You don't want to spend a ton of money on this. I don't want to spend a ton of money on this. Let's get to a point where we both can have a frank assessment of this case, and whether it's going to resolve quickly, whether it's going to be resolved by dispositive motion, or whether it's going to go to trial and we actually find those three or four documents that may actually be utilized. That's terrific if you have people that understand the processes, they have some sort of trust in one another, and they can utilize that methodology. Where you don't have that alignment, though, I think it's going to be far more difficult, and it may take a great deal of education, and more likely it's going to take intervention from the adjudicator of the matter.
But Judge Waxley, do you oftentimes see or at least hear from some of your judicial colleagues how often parties are coming up and discussing in detail what the costs of an overbroad preservation strategy entails, from collection to storage to review, and how much longer it will take them to actually finish a review and produce data to an opponent because it's overly broad?
You know, in the last 10 years, I've probably had three or four cases where preservation issues, disputes about preservation issues, have actually been brought for me to rule on. Most cases, this is taken care of without judicial intervention of any kind. So when I asked at the scheduling conference whether there are any problems, very seldom do I get into discussions about preservation. Now, one of the things we've done in our current guidelines that, of course, are available on our website is we added a list of questions that Craig Ball came up with in January 2008 and said, here, I mean, his article's talking about the questions you should answer in the meet and confer process. But if you look at his 50 questions, the ones that relate to preservation, and because we tell all counsel, look at these questions and make sure you can answer them. And that gets into preservation duties and the cost of preservation and forces people to upfront talk about this. Now, having it in the list and getting it discussed, you know, I don't have a good study that says how often that's happening, but we think by telling people at the very start, go have these discussions, that's the reason we're not having to deal with them very frequently. Now, I could be totally wrong, and they're all out there, and I'm just not aware of it, but that's my perspective at this point.
So, Alex, now sort of completing the loop in the technology play that I'm making here, it would seem to me that a targeted initial collection also lends themselves to some of these smarter review tools that are out there. And as the enemy of review of any form, any type of approach, is junk and irrelevant data. But by collecting in a more targeted manner, doesn't it make speed even more attainable with tools like predictive coding, which do very well with rich data collections? The TREC study no one's really talked about yet, TREC 2011, showed with rich data sets that most of the participants in the search did much better with a predictive coding type of a tool to quickly find lots of responsive data. Could this be an appealing carrot and stick strategy to encourage the use of some of this newer technology in a meet and confer process?
Yeah, I think it can definitely be a good carrot. And one of the interesting reasons why I got into e-discovery was because it really is the intersection between a fascinating space between big data and our legal profession. And some of these tools really speak to that, which is the predictive coding engines that are now being popularized, which have actually in some ways been around for a number of years now, maybe 4 or 5 years now. And having a sort of targeted collection is a good way to making that tool be effective. And I think you hit the nail on the head. I think there are some technical upsides to having a narrower collection. And getting rid of that junk and irrelevant data makes the search engine operate much more effectively. I never talk about specific vendors, but I've seen it cut across a number of platforms. And I kind of liken it and describe it like a sort of deep lake or a shallow lake, a 4 mile large lake or a 2 mile large lake. Predictive coding engines do better when you have a bucket of material that is going to have ideally a higher amount of relevance than a much bigger bucket of material that's not going to have very many relevant items. Most predictive coding engines start out by presenting a randomized set of material to an expert reviewer, usually a very senior member of the team, of the legal team, who then looks at that randomized set. A lot of the engines will pick 500 random documents from the data that's been collected, and then that expert, that knowledge expert, will look at the 500 documents and ideally find the 30 or 40 or 20 that are relevant to the case. And then from there, the algorithm recalculates and presents more documents to that knowledge expert. The problem with having such large collections is that the expert might sit down at the predictive coding engine and look at 500 documents, and there'll only be one relevant document. And that really is problematic on the predictive coding side. So I think that's an excellent point, which is a lot of the tools that we're looking to use and wanting to use do better when we have targeted initial collections from the key custodians who are most likely to have documents that are relevant to the litigation.
So I'm jumping around a little bit here to keep us in under an hour. Martin, one of the challenges that we have here is, if you're fearful of over-preservation, you got to give some cost estimate and provide the other side with some explanation of why you're digging too deep. Is it enough to just rely on common sense to not boil the ocean and grab all the ESI, or do you think, this is your guts as a, your insight as a litigator, do you think we need to go further and sample different data sources to satisfy an adversary?
Well, Carl, I think you have to be able to plausibly demonstrate why certain collections of ESI or a certain approach is preferable, or why certain collections of ESI are off the table in terms of verification. If you do it unilaterally, of course, there's always that risk that you'll be second-guessed way down the road when it's too late to do anything about it, and the cost of remediating it is unacceptable. So the key is to be able to somehow demonstrate, either through an articulate description of what is the source and why it doesn't pertain to the case at hand and shouldn't be collected or preserved, or to provide an example of it. I'll give you an example of a case not too long ago where we had a large number of structured data environments that the other side was very interested in seeing, because the other side thought that they might actually contain some information that would be important to the case. And having gone through it and having understood what they contained and what they didn't contain, I was pretty confident that I'd be able to demonstrate that they were not really anything that we ought to be preserving, collecting, much less producing, because they just weren't going to bear upon the issues in the case. And we had to come up with a way where I could demonstrate that through some sort of a listing of fields of data that were within the structured environment to satisfy the other side that this was certainly not something that we ought to be delving into, because the cost and the time and the investment on both sides, candidly, would just not be worth it, and it wasn't anyone's interest to do that. But I don't think just simply standing up and using charm and a smile is going to do it. I think you have to understand your environment, and that means working very closely with your client, because you can't explain something if you don't understand it yourself. And there's also, as I think Alex mentions, oftentimes there can be a reluctance on behalf of the client to even get into some of these things. And so you need to be able to educate them, vice versa, and encourage them to that, yes, this actually is to our benefit to explain to the other side why this ocean shouldn't be boiled. Because if we can't convince the other side and we end up having to take it up to the next level, we're going to have to be able to convince the judge that this isn't an ocean that should be boiled. So it's in our best interest to understand this and be able to do it in a plausible and, even more importantly, a defensible manner. And on the other side, obviously, the requesting party isn't going to take anybody at face value, and they shouldn't. At a minimum, to quote Ronald Reagan, it should be a trust but verify situation.
So, Alex, drawing on you've been throwing out lots of statistics, so I'm hoping you can provide some insight here. How hard is it in a large organization to cost estimate within a reasonable range on the cost of preserving and collecting disparate data sources? I mean, do we need standards or price lists for this type of work, or can a typically sophisticated forensics and collections company provide this type of data?
Sure. It is hard to measure, but it's not impossible. And one of the things that large enterprises are good at is measuring minutia like this. One of the things that I like to say at work is you cannot change what you do not measure. And that really kind of goes to the crux of I think what a lot of us are, Martin and Judge Waxy and I are talking about, which is we need better measurement. We need to have that level of granularity. We need to have that during the meet and confer process, so we can share that with outside counsel and sometimes even with our adversary. But I think it's an important thing to do, even if it is hard.
when it comes to comparing apples to apples and oranges to oranges, it is also challenging sometimes because of the workflow that some of the vendors use. Sometimes they are handling the data differently from their competitors, and it is hard to sometimes be able to quantify and place a dollar amount on how much we are spending at each stage of the process. But I think the most important starting point is to try to measure how much is being preserved. I think most companies don't do that, at measuring how much gets processed and how much gets reviewed and produced. There's some great resources out there, for instance, from EDRM.net, the folks that bring us the EDRM model. They've created a sort of framework for metrics, which could be a good starting point for many practitioners in this space that are looking to really get down into the granularity. But I think it's vitally important, and I think it's hard, but it's something that can be done. You just need to set aside a lot of time to do it.
So, Judge Waxy, I mean, if we look at some of these ideas we've thrown out here about maybe collecting more narrowly or trying to make the search tools work a little bit better on narrow data sets and approaching collection and preservation with some common sense, you know, isn't it true that we've been dispensing justice for a long time with flawed search techniques like the keyword problems that a lot of us talk about, where we didn't even sample what wasn't hitting search terms and had no idea what we were leaving behind? Or we look at records managers. Man, if you talk to records managers, they're open about how flawed their approach is because they're missing lots of records, especially with acquisitions. So don't witnesses and depositions and interrogatories provide other tools to get to the truth other than grabbing every single potential document? I mean, should we fear common sense approaches even if others haven't done them in large numbers?
No, I think we should clearly be relying on common sense in so many of these areas. I mean, it starts with common sense in just records management. There's no question most organizations overkeep. I mean, I'm not talking about preservation obligations. I'm just talking about what they keep to operate their business. That is a first step. If they'd have better record management systems that were legally compliant but not overly retaining information, that would help. The common sense thing, though, in terms of your reference to using depositions and interrogatories, the problem is those cost huge amounts of money, and those we're more and more seeing a really problematic method of getting at the truth or the relevant information. I mean, if you think lawyers are playing games with e-discovery, they've been playing games with depositions and interrogatories for the last 50 years, and some of them have gotten very good at it. You know, 26G is being revitalized simply because lawyers do these unbelievable things with interrogatories, both on the requesting and responding side, that just waste huge amounts of time and money. So common sense doesn't mean we just give up technology and move to the other discovery tools. It means we apply it across the board. And, you know, I want to mention something that I forgot to interject earlier, and that is this question of focusing so much on custodians. I think that is a big problem. I mean, first, in many organizations, the data doesn't really reside with custodians. It may reside in archives or servers or the various places you should focus as opposed to tying it to a person, which is why I think the Federal Circuit's suggestion that you just automatically start out with so many custodians doesn't make a lot of sense. It's too simplistic in terms of where the data might be and what should you do to get at it. So I think common sense is essential, but it really has to be in the context, sort of a risk-benefit analysis of, if we spend this much time and this much money, is it really worth what we're going to get out of this? And, you know, it gets back to cooperation again. Once you get your data on how much is it going to cost, you need to sit down with the other side, and it may be this piece of litigation makes absolutely no sense to litigate. We should settle it. It's going to cost way more to litigate than is at issue. So that focus on the big picture of what are we trying to do here, which is resolve a dispute, as opposed to how am I going to win this little battle on this piece of e-discovery?
So the last question I sometimes like to ask our guests is, today, October 22nd, 2012, what issue do you see as the biggest issue in the e-discovery field? And we'll start the way we introduced, Judge Waxy, then Alex, and Martin, you got to try to come up with something creative.
I mean, I think the biggest issue still is the lack of real knowledge, both on lawyers' and clients' sides of the case. I mean, I think the more people become educated to what's really going on here and what's really at issue, we're going to find more solutions. I see, you look at the sanction cases, for example, so many of those problems result from people not understanding what their obligations are and how to comply with their obligations. And, of course, some of it gets pretty simplistic. They result from people not telling the truth or hiding things. But if we could get counsel that are competent and educated and, of course, ethical, I think that would be the best way to resolve the issues we have on cost and delay.
And, Alex, your perspective?
Sure. I think Judge Waxy is correct, and I would actually add a little dimension to it, which is what I've now heard being called the Sedona bubble, or sometimes the e-discovery bubble, which is judges like Judge Waxy and folks like Martin and I are very knowledgeable about this. But when you step outside our small bubble, there are a lot of practitioners that have not been exposed to these concepts to a level of detail that will help them be versed in e-discovery to the point where we can take and draw the line where the risk is appropriate, have the right cost-benefit analysis, have the right collaborative approach to the meet and confer. So I think it's a matter of education, and it's a matter of stepping outside of the Sedona bubble and e-discovery bubble to help bring people closer together into this area.
Okay, and I'll add on that one, Alex. I couldn't agree more. It's one reason I probably spend a few days each month trying to help local markets set up these networking groups to cross-pollinate between Sedona EDRM into the local market of e-discovery professionals in situations where everyone knows each other and trusts each other because it's a local market. And I was just out in Minneapolis doing it, and we're working now in San Francisco and Baltimore, but that's like 8 or 9 different markets that have been involved with setting this sort of initiative up. And we got to get beyond the think tank groups, because not everyone can be in a think tank, but everyone deals with this problem. So I couldn't agree with you more on that one. Martin, how about yourself?
Well, we'll make it 4 for 4, because clearly education has been, is, and will continue to be the single largest challenge when it comes to achieving all the goals that we've been talking about for the last hour with respect to e-discovery. And it's, in addition to what Alex said, getting beyond the Sedona bubble, but also getting it down to what I call small stakes and small data, because there's just as many challenges in a different way for the client that runs into a lawyer's office with a cell phone saying, I have a threatening text message from someone. How do I use this in my case? And what tools are available to that lawyer? What does that lawyer understand about what his or her obligations are, as there are in the multi-terabyte or exabyte cases where you're typically going to have a lot of tools and vendors and resources? But that's not every case. There are a lot of cases out there that don't involve those types of issues, but still have e-discovery challenges that I think the resources that are available need to be brought to them, or they need to have them at their disposal and able to use in their everyday cases. Obviously, technology-assisted review will continue to be the hot topic for some time. There will also continue to be raging debate about whether or not there needs to be amendment to the Federal Civil Procedure with respect to preservation, what, when, and what happens if you don't. And then last, I would be remiss if I didn't mention that I think possession, custody, and control is continuing to be a major challenge, whether you're talking about social media, cloud computing, or the new hot one, which is bring your own devices. Because with the mass consumerization of devices, where employers are only too happy to let their employees bring their own devices to work and utilize them in business, that creates a huge legal and practical challenge for preservation. And the law is not consistent on this. And then, of course, the practical challenge is it's someone else's device, not yours. Yet if you're going to be charged with possession, custody, and control of it, we can all think about what those challenges are, but that's for another call.
Yep, we're always playing catch-up in this field. So, well, I want to thank Judge Waxy, Alex, and Martin for joining us here at ESI Bytes. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. I'd like to continue to thank our sponsor, Chernov, for their continued support of ESI Bytes. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. You can remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes of ESI information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.